Good evening. Hi, everybody. I'm Deborah Margolis. I'm the librarian that works with the Muslim Studies program. And welcome to the MSU Libraries tonight. This is the culminating event in our Muslim Journeys series this semester. And whether you've been attending the book discussion group through the long winter, or if you're just coming out tonight since it's finally spring, we're very happy to have you here. And I know we're all in for a real treat tonight, and we'll take a journey with Dr. Khalil. I'm just going to give a few thank yous to the MSU Libraries and our Digital Multimedia Center, John Shaw, for all the support, and also mention our Diversity Advisory Committee, whose members also supported this program. Thanks to the Muslim Studies program, and in particular, Julia Grimm, who helped out with publicizing this program, the MSU Honors College, our local partners, the Islamic Society of Greater Lansing, and the East Lansing Area Clergy Association. On the state level, the Michigan Humanities Council, and then nationally, this is a program of the National Endowment for the Humanities and administered by the American Library Association. So now it's my privilege to introduce Muhammad Khalil. Muhammad Hassan Khalil is an associate professor of religious studies here at MSU. He's an adjunct professor in the College of Law and the interim director of the Muslim Studies program. He specializes in Islamic thought, and he's the author of Islam and the Fate of Others, The Salvation Question, which that's the title of his book that you see up on the screen. And he's also the editor of a volume called Between Heaven and Hell, Islam, Salvation, and the Fate of Others, which you can find them both in our library. Tonight, he's going to share his research with us, and he's going to lecture on the fate of non-Muslims in the afterlife, contemporary debates in Islamic thought.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, Deborah. Deborah Margolis has done an outstanding job putting this program together. I think she deserves another round of applause. Well, good evening. I'd like to begin with a question. What does Islam say about the fate of non-Muslims? This somewhat simplistic, yet often asked question has clear and profound theological and practical implications. It also tends to evoke one-dimensional responses. And with professors, pundits, and politicians debating whether we are approaching or even already engaged in a clash of civilizations, there has been a recent proliferation of discourses that present the matter in black and white. One popular sentiment is that Islam condemns non-Muslims, all non-Muslims, to everlasting damnation. In this light, the people who died on September 11 were nothing more than fuel for the eternal fires of God's justice, Sam Harris proclaims in his New York Times bestseller, The End of Faith. An entirely different response, less common but gaining currency, is that Islam at its core is an ecumenical tradition, one that recognizes other paths to God. This is precisely the point that Riza Aslan makes in his celebrated book, No God But God, as he describes Jews and Christians as spiritual cousins to Muslims. In point of fact, the question at hand is not a simple one, regardless of whether by Islam one means the sacred scriptures or the scriptures of the tradition or interpretations based on those scriptures. Muslim scholars generally agree that in the life to come, some will rejoice and others will suffer. But who exactly will rejoice and who exactly will suffer? And what is the nature and duration of the rejoicing and suffering? These are questions that Muslim scholars have long debated. These are questions that Muslim scholars have long debated. Today, I'd like to show you some of the responses by Muslim theologians and scholars to this question. But first, some general remarks. What does the Quran have to say about salvation, about the afterlife, about heaven, about hell? Well, an obvious starting point is Surah 103, the 103rd chapter of the Quran. Here we read, "By the declining day, humanity is deep in loss, except for those who have faith, do good deeds, urge one another to the truth, and urge one another to steadfastness." Many Muslim scholars maintain that this chapter summarizes much of the Quranic message, if not all of it. The message is unambiguous. People must choose their life paths wisely because there are consequences. In the Quran, we see that the Prophet Muhammad, like other prophets, brings good news and warns people. He brings good news of continuous reward to those who have faith and do good works. His warnings are of continuous chastisement, punishment. And this is given to those who reject faith and deny God's revelations. And as we read elsewhere in the Quran, this is often tied to their attitude toward the poor, toward the orphans. They are negligent, arrogant, and so on. And yet, there is an important qualification here. And it appears in, among other places, Surah 17, verse 15. Here we read, "We," and "we" here is God speaking in the royal plural, "we do not punish until we have sent a messenger." In other words, people have to receive a message, before a divine message, before they can be held responsible for their response to that message. Because of this and similar qualifications, most Muslim theologians are what I would call inclusivists. And here is how I define inclusivists. Inclusivists are those who believe Islam is the path to salvation, but they also believe that God will save sincere non-Muslims. Now the question, of course, that comes to our mind is, well, who exactly qualifies as a sincere non-Muslim? And that's the subject of much debate. To give you an appreciation for the diversity of inclusivisms, I'd like to look at the views of three very prominent Muslim scholars: Al-Ghazali, or simply Ghazali, Ibn al-Arabi, or simply Ibn Arabi, and Ibn Taymiyyah. If you're familiar with Islamic studies or the study of Islam, you know that these are among the most well-known, the most influential scholars in the history of Islam. And the reason why I'm mentioning these pre-modern scholars is because they are often invoked in contemporary discussions. You cannot understand contemporary discourse, Muslim discourse, without understanding pre-modern Muslim discourse. So let's take a look at the views of Al-Ghazali, Ibn Arabi, and Ibn Taymiyyah. Let's begin with Ghazali, the very famous Persian theologian and scholar who is widely considered the most influential Muslim theologian of all time. Al-Ghazali was of the view that damnation is real, suffering in the afterlife is real, and there is everlasting chastisement. But for Al-Ghazali, this was the exception rather than the norm. Al-Ghazali argues that because of God's overwhelming mercy, it will be unusual, it will be rare for someone to merit or to deserve everlasting chastisement. He says that just as in this life, it's rare to find someone who is suicidal, it will be rare in the afterlife to find someone who will be punished eternally. And he makes this argument on the basis of the well-attested mercy of God. Throughout the Quran, we see references to God's wrath. We see that God is strict in punishment. God is severe in punishment. But God is also the forgiving, the loving, the peace. And at the beginning of almost every surah or chapter of the Quran, we read, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the Lord of mercy, the giver of mercy. Or you could translate it, the lovingly compassionate, the lovingly caring. So because of this emphasis on mercy, and kind of, it's a kind of loving mercy, it's related to the term rahim, which is the womb of the mother, the center of loving mercy. Because of this emphasis on mercy, Al-Ghazali says we should assume that in the afterlife, God's mercy will overwhelm or overtake or outstrip his wrath. And this, in fact, is what the Prophet Muhammad himself is quoted as saying in various hadiths, various reports. So for Al-Ghazali, most of humanity will be saved. It's rare for someone to be punished eternally. But Al-Ghazali, so with this in mind, Al-Ghazali proceeds to discuss the fate of non-Muslims. And he says that most non-Muslims will be saved. Who will be damned then? Well, he comes up with a list of, he says that there are four kinds of non-Muslims. The first, those who never heard of the Prophet. And Ghazali says, these non-Muslims are excused. They never heard of the Prophet. The second group, those who heard only negative things about the Prophet. For Al-Ghazali, they similarly have not really heard of the prophetic message, so they cannot be held accountable for not following the Prophet's message. The third group, those who have heard about the Prophet, they hear good things about the Prophet, and yet they reject his message without investigating it, without caring for it, turning away from it, and that's it. And for Al-Ghazali, these are the non-Muslims who would be culpable before God. Then you have a fourth category, and that is non-Muslims who hear about the Prophet, hear good things about the Prophet, and begin to actively investigate his message. And then they pass away without ever having converted, but they were in that state of searching, investigating. For Al-Ghazali, these non-Muslims would be saved. So the only non-Muslims that Al-Ghazali considers culpable are those who hear about the Prophet, hear good things about the Prophet, and refuse to investigate further. Okay. The next scholar that I'd like to look at is the Sufi Ibn al-Arabi, or Ibn Arabi, who was from Al-Andalus, or Muslim Spain, or Iberia. Ibn al-Arabi is, again, an extremely influential scholar, and you'll find some of my colleagues at other universities claiming that he is the second most influential theologian of all time. I've never actually ranked them, but clearly an influential figure. Ibn al-Arabi believed that God is all. You can see the attributes of God in everything. And he argued that everything ultimately moves toward God. And so he argues, in the end, everyone will be pleased somehow. And yet he still believes in hell. He still maintains that there are some people who will remain in hell forever. But he says that they will experience the pain of hell until they finally submit to God, at which point they begin to enjoy hell because God transforms their bodies and they begin to there's a passage in the Quran that describes how Abraham, the prophet Abraham, and this does not appear in the canonical Bible, it appears in some non-canonical texts, but in the Quran there's a story of Abraham being thrown into a fire. And he feels that it's cool, he is saved, it's a miracle. So Ibn Arabi says, similarly, the people of hell, once they submit to God, they'll begin to enjoy hell. And so then the question is, okay, well, what's the difference then between heaven and hell? For Ibn Arabi, the key difference is that the people of hell remain veiled from God. They don't get to experience the ultimate pleasure. So then, we have to ask, who gets to go to heaven? Who gets to experience God? For Ibn Arabi, Islam is a superior religion. He sees Islam as a superior religion. So he's not a pluralist. He believes in Islamic supersessionism. He says that, you know, the other religions are like stars, and when Islam appears, it's like the sun. You no longer see the stars, but it doesn't mean that the stars aren't special still. They're still special, but for him, Islam is like the sun. It encompasses the other religions. For Ibn al-Arabi then, Islam is the ideal path to God. But, he says, the only non-Muslims who would be culpable are those who do not see Islam as the truth. In other words, they hear about Islam, they know about Islam, and yet they don't find it compelling. There's nothing there that they find compelling in their heart of hearts. For Ibn al-Arabi, these non-Muslims would be excused by God because they're sincere still. There's still that sincerity. And so he says, you know, non-Muslims who never heard of Islam, they'd be excused. Non-Muslims who hear about Islam but don't find it compelling, they would be excused. And they can still arrive, they can still make their way to God and still make their way to paradise. In fact, he says that paradise has over 5,000, this is his terminology, degrees, and only 12 of them are for Muslims. So he has in mind many non-Muslims going to paradise. Okay, so that's Ibn al-Arabi. The third scholar is a very different scholar, and that's Ibn Taymiyyah, Syrian traditionalist scholar. And Ibn Taymiyyah has a reputation of being a conservative, traditionalist scholar. That's the reputation. And indeed, there are some views that he has, that he maintains, that are indeed considered, you could say, are on the quote-unquote conservative side. When it comes to the issue of which non-Muslims are culpable, he is on the conservative side. He says that any non-Muslim who hears about the Islamic message and they receive the Islamic message in its proper form, they have to accept it then and there. He doesn't get into, oh, well, maybe if they investigate it or if they don't find it compelling. No. For him, Islam is inherently compelling. When people hear about Islam, they should be compelled to accept it. But what's interesting about Ibn Taymiyyah is that while he was imprisoned in the citadel of Damascus, he often got into trouble with the political leaders of his era. While he was imprisoned in the citadel of Damascus, he had time to write one more treatise before his pen was confiscated. And it's an interesting treatise. He argues in this last work of his that one day every single person will be saved. He believes in hell, he believes in punishment in hell, but he believes that one day everyone, not just believers, unbelievers, Pharaoh, Satan, everyone will be saved eventually. He makes this argument by pointing again to God's mercy, divine mercy. He says, isn't it interesting that in the Quran, God is called the compassionate, the caring, the loving, the forgiving, but he's never once called the punisher or the torturer. He is strict in punishment, he is severe in punishment, but he is never called the torturer or the punisher. Now, some of you might be wondering, well, wait a minute now. I've seen those 99 names of God lists that many Muslims have in their homes, And I've seen that some of the names of God include the harmer, Ad-Dar in Arabic. Well, this name never appears in the Quran. And so Ibn Taymiyyah's argument is that God never once is called the something that connotes punishment. It's always a verb that's used. You know, God punishes, God causes harm, but he is not the harmer. And so he says God's essence is an essence of mercy. So then, what is the point of punishing? What is the point of hell? For Ibn Taymiyyah, it's basically like purgatory. A long-lasting, very painful purgatory. He says that this is the purpose of hell is simply to rectify people. That this is like when you go to a doctor and they say you have to amputate a limb, and even though you know it's painful, you know it serves a purpose. So you do it anyway. So he says the punishment in hell, it's severe, it's extreme, it's awful, but it serves a purpose. And that purpose is to rectify those who would otherwise not be rectified. And so Ibn Taymiyyah makes this argument. He points to verses in the Quran that he considers evidence of temporal damnation or limited damnation. You know, most Muslim scholars believe that anyone with an iota of faith in their hearts will be saved. Now, Ibn Taymiyyah goes a step further. He's saying everybody will be saved eventually. Okay. Now, with that in mind, what we see here is we have two common themes among the scholars I've mentioned thus far. The first is Islamic supersessionism. In other words, people consider, these scholars that we've seen, they consider Islam the supreme religion. They're not pluralists in the sense, meaning they don't believe that there are multiple religions that are equally true. In fact, I found it extremely difficult to find a clear-cut example of a pre-modern Muslim pluralist. Even Rumi, the famous poet who talks about, you know, the many ways of you know, approaching God, even he, in one passage, criticizes, rebukes a Christian named Al-Jarrah for being Christian and not being Muslim. So it's very difficult. In fact, I couldn't find a clear-cut example of a pre-modern, a significant, a prominent pre-modern Muslim pluralist. By the same token, I found it very difficult to find a clear-cut example of a pre-modern Muslim exclusivist, meaning, and you'll see these terms in a moment, someone who says only Muslims could ever go to heaven. I found it extremely difficult. In fact, I only found one clear-cut example, and that was a scholar named Ibn Hazm, who was living during an era of Reconquista angst and in Muslim Spain, and he makes the unusual claim that everybody has heard about the Prophet, and even if you hear rumors about him, that counts. You are responsible before God. He is the only, and so he says everyone is responsible. This is the only person I could find who is a clear-cut example of a pre-modern Muslim exclusivist. Everyone else, they might make statements that seem exclusivistic, but then they'll ultimately qualify it by saying, but maybe they didn't receive the message, or they didn't receive it properly. We don't know. Only God knows. Okay. And so what's interesting about these pre-modern discussions is we see an emphasis on mercy, divine mercy, or rahmah. And here you see the statement that I mentioned earlier that appears at the beginning of almost every chapter of the Quran, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the Lord of mercy, the giver of mercy. Okay. Now, with this, interestingly, many assume that when Muslim scholars, theologians emphasize divine mercy, that this is some kind of modern trend. Here is a passage from somebody who's actually a friend of mine, and he actually invited me to a conference 2 weeks from now, so I don't want to be too mean here, but he says, David Marshall says in the book God, Muhammad, and the Unbelievers, The attractive emphasis on the centrality in the Quran of divine mercy is more of a modern trend. And in my research, I find the opposite to be true. I find Ghazali, Ibn Arabi, and Ibn Taymiyyah, and many others stressing mercy and elevating it above all other divine attributes in their discussions of salvation. So, what are the modern trends? Well, first of all, we see a growth of Muslim pluralism. Pluralism here in the context of salvation discourse. And here I define pluralism again as those who see, or pluralists, as those who see Islam as but one of multiple paths that are equally salvific, meaning they're just as good for those who seek salvation. We see a growth of pluralism in the modern context. And just to give you an example of some of the scholars, Muslim scholars, who promote pluralism, here are three examples. Abdul Aziz Sashidina, professor, who argues that even if a Christian or a Jew sees Islam as compelling, he or she can remain a Christian or a Jew and expect to be saved if he or she is righteous. Notice that he limits it to the Abrahamic traditions. And really, here I mean Christian and Jewish. Doesn't mention Baha'is, doesn't mention Hindus and Buddhists. Then you have Farid Ishaq, a prominent South African scholar who stresses deeds rather than creeds. For him, what really matters is what people do, not what they believe. And he points to passages in the Quran that condemn unbelievers. And he points out that often, it's not just a condemnation of their creed, it's a condemnation of the other things that they are doing, not helping the poor, not helping their neighbors, murder, etc. So pointing to the bad behavior of these of the unbelievers and saying that this is what the Quran is condemning rebuking, not purely their creeds, their faith. Then you have William Chittick, who takes the thinking of the Sufi Ibn Arabi and expands it, basically says that there are multiple equally true paths, and one can reach the divine through Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, etc. And I'm not doing justice to these scholars, but just because of the limited time here. And pluralists will often justify their claims by pointing to various Quranic passages. Here I'd like to highlight two. The first is Surah 5, chapter 5 of the Quran, the Islamic holy book, verse 48. Here we read, "We," and that's again, this is God speaking in the royal plural, "we have assigned a law and a path to each of you. If God had so willed, he would have made you one community. But he wanted to test you through that which he has given you. So race to do good. You will all return to God, and he will make clear to you the matters about which you differed." For the pluralists, this is an explicit affirmation of diversity. It's saying that God wants diversity. We all could have been one religious community, but he wanted this diversity. So race to do good. Critics would argue that this is not an endorsement of other non-Islamic paths, especially in a context in which Islam is available, God's final revelation. So they would say that, you know, maybe this is addressed to the Muslims and then the earlier communities that preceded the Muslims. Some would say, but wait a minute, why is it saying race to do good? It seems to be talking to people who are alive now. Another response to that is, well, okay, but it's not necessarily saying that the other paths are equally true. So there's an interesting debate that goes on there. Another passage that pluralists often invoke or cite, and this is perhaps the most often cited passage in pluralist discourse is Surah 2, chapter 2, verse 62. And by the way, you'll find a similar passage in Surah 5, verse 69. This reads, "The believers, the Jews, the Christians, and the Sabians." Who are the Sabians? Do you have an evening free? There's a lot of debate. Some would say it's a group of star worshipers in Iraq. Some would say it's a heterodox Christian movement. I mean, there's so many different theories. Some say it's a term for other. Anyway, the believers, the Jews, the Christians, and the Sabians, all those who have faith in God and the last day and do good, will have their rewards with their Lord, no fear for them, nor will they grieve. For the pluralist, this is an explicit affirmation of pluralism. Critics, however, argue that the meaning here is restricted. For instance, the term the Jews, the Christians, these we should think of these maybe as tribal designations. So in this case, you could have a Jew who believes in the prophethood of Muhammad, right? So the idea is, they would say that this isn't just any Jew or any Christian, it's a Jew or a Christian who basically becomes Muslim. That's the argument. Some even argue that this verse was abrogated, it was canceled out, but that's not a particularly popular opinion. Okay, so much for the pluralists. We also see in modern times the growth of exclusivism. And I define exclusivists as those who see Islam, who consider Islam as the only salvific path, the only path that leads to salvation, and all non-Muslims will be damned. And here we mean non-Muslims after the era of the Prophet Muhammad. Because obviously before Muhammad, you have, Abraham is considered a Muslim. Joseph, Jesus, they're all considered Muslims. What does the word Muslim mean? Those of you who had me before. What's a Muslim? One who submits to God, right? And so, in any case, for exclusivists, with the arrival of the Prophet Muhammad, all non-Muslims are damned. And just to give you an example of some scholars who promote this view, here are two. The first is a popular preacher, Indian preacher, named Zakir Naik. And you will see on YouTube numerous clips of Zakir Naik. Has maybe the best memory I've ever seen in my life. And what's interesting here is that he takes a pretty hard stance on the question of non-Muslim salvation. He's asked about the fate of Mother Teresa, for instance. And he says, well, let's assume that Mother Teresa really was a good person. And he has his doubts about that, but he says, let's assume that she really is. Because she was not a Muslim, she would have to be damned. She may have passed, it's like in school, you might have various subjects, but if you fail one subject, you have failed. And so he says that because she did not have faith in Islam, she would be damned. Then you have Sayyid Qutb, an Egyptian Islamist thinker who was executed in 1966. Sayyid Qutb is interesting because he writes while he's imprisoned and while he's being tortured in Egypt. And I don't know if you're familiar with Egyptian prisons, not the nicest place. And I can say that as somebody who's Egyptian, I guess. That was supposed to be a joke, not funny, that's okay. Sayyid Qutb, what's interesting about Sayyid Qutb is, in his earlier writings, he seems to be open to the idea of non-Muslim salvation. Okay, it's possible, God knows best. But in his later years, as he endures much torture, we see him taking a stronger stance. And he says, really, it's only certain Muslims who will be saved, period. Not Muslims, certain Muslims, and the idea of non-Muslim salvation is effectively ruled out. And this is interesting because Sayyid Qutb is someone who influences a wide variety of people. And again, notice his writings evolve over time. So you have people who are moved by some of his earlier writings, people who are moved by some of his later writings. But an extremely influential figure nonetheless. And exclusivists will often point to a passage like this. Surah 3, chapter 3, verse 85. Here we read, if anyone seeks a religion or way, the Arabic word is deen, other than Islam or al-Islam, it will not be accepted from him or her. He or she will be one of the losers in the hereafter. So for the exclusivist, it's pretty clear cut. If you do not follow Islam, you are going to hell. Now, critics argue that the term Islam or al-Islam simply means the submission or the surrender to God. It is not the formal name for the religion of the Prophet Muhammad. And again, they would say, well, look, Abraham is called a Muslim, one who submits. Joseph is called a Muslim, one who submits to God. The disciples of Jesus are called Muslims. They precede Muhammad, and yet they are called Muslims because they submit to God. So the response here is that it's not that you have to follow the religion that later people designated as the, you know, that was given to the religion of Muhammad. Actually, many historians would tell you that the idea that Islam is the name of Islam was actually a later development, a post-Muhammadan development. During the lifetime of the Prophet, he would use the term Islam. He would also use the term faith, iman. He would use various terms to refer to his community and his tradition. It's only in later decades that we see Muslims calling themselves Muslim. In fact, early Muslims would say we are muhajirun or mu'minun, or which means like emigrants or believers. They used various terms. It was only in later decades that people began using the term Islam and Muslim as the official name for the religion. Another claim passages that exclusivists will point to are the various passages in which we see the Quran critiquing and condemning Jews, Christians, and others. And here the response by pluralists and inclusivists is that these passages are limited to specific Jews, specific Christians, and other non-Muslims. What is more, these passages appear in a certain context. You know, it's in response to something specific, and so we have to contextualize these verses. We cannot, run with them and overgeneralize. Okay. Another development, and I'm almost done. Another development that we see, excuse me, puberty again, apparently. We also see modern scholars denying and promoting Ibn Taymiyyah's case for the eventual salvation of all. Remember, Ibn Taymiyyah was the third pre-modern scholar we saw. He's the one who said in the last treatise that he writes that one day everyone will be saved. Well, this is a controversial claim. To say that Pharaoh, Satan, could one day be saved, that's controversial. And many after Ibn Taymiyyah would declare him a heretic because of this claim. So what's interesting is that you see some of Ibn Taymiyyah's supporters denying that Ibn Taymiyyah, first of all, they deny the position, and then they deny that Ibn Taymiyyah ever said that. But what I found in my research is that these denials are modern denials for the most part. They come centuries after Ibn Taymiyyah. No one during Ibn Taymiyyah's time denies that Ibn Taymiyyah held this view. In fact, his student, famous student, Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, would expand on it in three separate works. And Ibn Taymiyyah's critics would, refute his argument. And yet nobody denies that Ibn Taymiyyah was of this view. This only comes in later centuries. So now if you go home tonight and you Google Ibn Taymiyyah and hell, you will find many people denying that Ibn Taymiyyah held this view. These are later denials. On the flip side, you have people you wouldn't expect them to support Ibn Taymiyyah, and yet you'll see them promoting his argument. For example, there's a group called the Ahmadiyya. And the Ahmadiyya, this is a group you will see in Pakistan, India, various places. And it's a group that, I'll just say this, you don't typically see Ibn Taymiyyah cited in their writings. And yet, when it comes to this question of hell and the duration of hell, they cite it, they invoke it. And they really take Ibn Taymiyyah's formulation of the argument and modify it a bit. Interestingly, the Nation of Islam, right here in America, Elijah Muhammad, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who then influences Malcolm X, would take from the Ahmadiyya their argument for a non-everlasting hell. Many assume that in the Nation of Islam, there is no concept of hell. No, there is a concept of hell. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in his writings in the 50s, says, yeah, hell will come to an end, and he lays out the argument, and it looks a lot like Ibn Taymiyyah's argument, interestingly. And by the way, in case you're wondering, you know, the Nation of Islam is known for its statement, the white man is the devil, right? This is a famous statement associated with the Nation of Islam. You should know that in 1972, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was asked, this is his title, by the way, he was asked about this, and he said that when we say the white man is the devil, we mean it as a kind of in a symbolic way. And so for him, he really has in mind a temporal hell in which everyone could one day be saved, even the quote-unquote, those, or the, even whites. Even though, you know, maybe some of the other members of the Muslim Nation of Islam would refer to white people as devils. Again, in this 1972 interview, he says, yeah, we mean it in a kind of symbolic way. We don't mean that they are actually devils who are going to hell forever. So anyway, so this is another interesting modern development. So to go back to our question, what does Islam say about the fate of non-Muslims? However one chooses to respond to this question, I submit that a deeper appreciation of the rich diversity of views is both necessary and overdue. Thank you. All right, let's see. We have plenty of time for questions. Let's have at it. Yes?
You testified that Ibn Taymiyyah's
view. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is it extant?
Yes, it is. The question was the treatise by Ibn Taymiyyah in which he argues for a non-eternal hell. Is it extant? Do we have it? Yes, we actually have an entire manuscript and an abbreviated manuscript in Cairo and Beirut. And it was actually published for the first time in 1995 in Saudi Arabia. But interestingly, the editor had a preface where he says, Ibn Taymiyyah can say these kinds of things. Us regular folks, we can't say these kinds of things. And if he's wrong, he's wrong. He's at a point where he can make these kinds of claims because he's qualified to make these kinds of claims. And if he's wrong, he's wrong. But for us average folks, we shouldn't get into this. And yet he still took the time to publish, right? So anyway, but yeah, it was published in 1995. Yeah. Yes, Han.
Thank you, it was so interesting. Can you say a few words about Shiite approach?
Yes.
And maybe two more. I didn't understand why it's surprising that Ahmadiyya embraced this idea. For me, it seems not surprising at all. And the third one, just a suggestion, I don't know enough about it, but maybe a pro-modern thinker who is more pluralist, although not completely. I don't think that any religion, even Baha'ism, is so inclusive. But if you look carefully, there's a clear hierarchy. There's no question about it. So only religion without center can be completely inclusive, but maybe pre-modern thinker is Mohinuddin Chishti. I think he is might be an example.
Thank you. Yeah, great observation. Certainly could be. Going back to the first question about Shiite thought. So in my book, I have a disclaimer that my specialty is Sunni thought. That said, I do look at Shiite scholars, and among Shiite scholars, you do see a similar range of views. So for instance, going back to, I was hoping it was a lot sooner than that, here we go. In the Arabi, we see Mullah Sadra, very famous Shiite scholar, promoting a very similar view, about especially the part about hell becoming enjoyable, right? And when we look at the modern scholars, Abdulaziz Sheshedina, he's a Shiite scholar. We actually see in the contemporary discourse, Shiites playing a very significant role, a very prominent role in the discourse. So here I only included a few examples, but in my book I look at several examples, and half at least are Shiite, even though, you know, proportionally they're maybe what?
Is there a significant difference in Shiism? I mean, I don't know anything about it, but I'm interested to know, is there significant difference between Ismailiyah and Shia al-Itna'a-Sariya?
Well, let's save the Ismailiyah for a second. Let me just go back to this point about Shiite thought and the differences. Yeah, there are differences with regard to the means by which one attains salvation. You know, in the Shiite context, the imam, the leader, the infallible leader, plays a significant role in the salvation process. But when you're looking at, you know, the end result, you find a similar range of views. You know, there are those who say, you know, only Shiites go to heaven, and only certain Shiites. And you have others who are pluralists, like Sheshedina. So you see a wide range of views within within Shiism. And then as for the Ismailis, here I'm just going to be careful. I'm just because, you know, I haven't spent too much time studying Ismaili thought. I'm familiar with their discourse on reincarnation, or at least what, or tanasukh, which could be translated as reincarnation. It's more complicated in the Ismaili context, and here we're talking more about philosophy. It's more philosophical, perhaps, than theological, if that makes sense. I don't feel qualified to speak about the Ismaili context. As for the Ahmadiyya, you asked the question, why would it be surprising that they would promote the view of a non-eternal hell? That part is fine. I understand that part. What I found surprising was the fact that they invoked Ibn Taymiyyah, and they actually mentioned him by name. And that was surprising because you won't see him really appear anywhere, in other writings. And you might see Ibn al-Arabi, the Sufi, but you don't really see Ibn Taymiyyah. And Ibn Taymiyyah's views on many issues, social, ethical, political issues, doesn't really match up with what we typically think of when we think of the Ahmadiyya. Let's maybe take a new question. Yeah.
My question was, what about the non-Abrahamic beliefs?
Right.
Are they mentioned at all, or are they just not included at all? And if so, if they are mentioned, what
do they say? What do these three schools of thought say about these non-Abrahamic?
So the non-Abrahamic traditions. Okay. Well, let me give you the easiest answer, and that is, let's look at the inclusivists, really the majority of Muslim theologians. Interestingly, they didn't really care so much, or at least many of them, most of them, don't really care whether one is, let's say, Christian, Hindu, or even pagan or atheist. Their major concern was, what has one been exposed to? So they would say, if you've been exposed to some form of divine revelation, in a proper manner, you are properly exposed to this revelation, then you would be expected to respond in an appropriate way. So for example, Al-Ghazali, he says, you know, there are many Christians and many Turkic pagans who've never heard of Islam, and they would be excused, even though he's speaking about pagans. So, and I use pagan here in the academic sense, not in a kind of derogatory, pejorative way. And so for many of the inclusivists, it really doesn't matter. What they care about is, what have you been exposed to? So for example, Ibn Taymiyyah, and I know I'm throwing out a bunch of names here, but Ibn Taymiyyah was the third person we looked at. He has, you could say the conservative view out of the three we looked at with regard to salvation on the Day of Judgment. Ibn Taymiyyah says, if you've never heard of Islam, you're excused. But let's say you've heard of Christianity, then you would have to become a Christian. And even if you arrive at a belief that's considered problematic in an Islamic context, like the Trinity, that would be okay. Because as long as you're sincere, then you're just going by what's in front of you. And he says, if you haven't heard of Christianity, and you've heard of Judaism, you would have to accept Judaism. Now, he doesn't mention the other traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, and others. But again, for him, certainly if you are exposed to the Abrahamic traditions for Ibn Taymiyyah, you would have to follow those traditions. Okay, for others, for the pluralists, it's more complicated. And the reason it's complicated is because it's unclear whether Hinduism and Buddhism could be considered true religions, or religions that were originally divinely revealed. So the reason why Jews and Christians are called people of the book, and the reason why there's this special status, they have the special status, is because it's believed that they have divine truths in their scripture. But maybe the texts have been modified or altered. At least that's the dominant view among Muslim theologians. So as for Hinduism and Buddhism and other traditions, Zoroastrianism, you see a wide range of views. I remember we had when I was at the University of Illinois, we invited a Muslim scholar from Pakistan, and every time he'd mention Buddha's name, he'd say, "The Lord Buddha, peace be upon him," because he saw Buddha as a prophet from God. So, you know, it depends. Are these originally divinely revealed traditions, or are they not? That's where you're going to find, the debate. The Quran only mentions Jews, Christians, Sabians, Zoroastrians, and pagans. And I think those are the major traditions that are mentioned in the Quran. Yeah.
With what you said earlier with Sabians, other religions.
Right. Right, so some people make that argument.
Okay.
And by the way, some people argue that there are hints of Buddha in the Quran, and there are hints of Indian prophets, Hindu prophets in the Quran. There's a verse that refers to where God swears by the fig, and some say this is like the fig tree that Buddha, people try to make those connections, but there's certainly nothing explicit. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, Susan.
Literally, if we don't think of where is heaven, where is hell, to me what is interesting, and I know, except for Arabi, I know nothing about these, is the whole thing of compassion. The whole thing will depend on how much you stress compassion versus the judgment.
Right.
So don't you think that's the kind of linchpin of all of these debates?
Yeah. In the conclusion to my book, I say that if you look at these scholars, Al-Ghazali, Ibn Arabi, Ibn Taymiyyah, and then some of the modern scholars, you see that they're all willing to take what I call a hermeneutical leap of mercy, going beyond what is explicit in scripture without necessarily contradicting it. Because they feel compelled to invoke mercy. And so because of this vision of mercy and compassion, if you look at all of them, the three pre-modern scholars we looked at, in the end, they imagine that at least the overwhelming majority of humanity will be in paradise. It's only Ghazali, really, who says a small minority will remain in hell. Ibn Arabi says, with Ibn Arabi, there are some in hell, but it becomes like a paradise of sorts. And then Ibn Taymiyyah, everybody's in heaven. So they have a vision, because of this emphasis on mercy, they go that extra step. The Quran never says explicitly, most people are going to heaven. It never says explicitly that the people in hell are going to enjoy themselves. And some would argue maybe not even implicitly. And then you have the thing about everyone leaving hell and going to heaven. I mean, there are some passages in the Quran you could argue are hints. For example, there's a verse in the Quran that says the unbelievers will remain in hell, imprisoned in hell. They'll never go to heaven until the camel passes through the eye of the needle. Now, if you're familiar with the New Testament, that might sound familiar, doesn't it? Of course, in a different context. In the New Testament, it is the wealthy will not enter the kingdom of God, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of the needle than for somebody who's wealthy to enter the kingdom of God. And maybe I'm butchering the quote, but you get the point. And then the disciples, what? So how are the wealthy? And then what does Jesus say? Matthew, all things are possible with God. All things are possible with God. So some could argue, well, with the Quran, if you go use that logic, all things are possible with God. Maybe the unbelievers could go to heaven. So, I mean, Ibn Taymiyyah points to passages that say that the unbelievers will remain in hell for ages. And he says, well, if it's really forever, why not just say forever? Why would you say for ages? For him, that's a limit. And there's a verse that says, Surah 6, verse 128, they will remain in hell unless God wills otherwise. So he points to these passages to make his argument. And he even cites reports that indicate that some of the earliest Muslims were of this view. For example, there's a statement attributed to Umar, the second caliph, in which he says that one day, after a long time, everyone will leave hell. And so now the question is, did he really say that? Is this an authentic report? This is where you get much of the debate. So, yes, next question. Yes.
Just a thought regarding the Ismailis.
Yes. Yeah.
And it could be just a deduction. I haven't read it or anything like that. But the Ismailis have a present imam.
Right.
And
the Nazaris, at least, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Nazaris are, they have the present Aga Khan as the imam, and he's pretty liberal. So he could be within the league of those modern trends, which give us the pluralism rather than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that were the case. I mean, I'd be inclined to think that as well, yeah.
And the other question is, there is a mention of 124,000
prophets. Yes.
Is it in Quran or is it in?
It's not in the Quran.
Reports.
Yeah. So there's in the Hadith corpus, in the prophetic reports, the reports attributed to the Prophet. There's a statement that there have been 124,000 prophets. Now only 20 some odd prophets appear in the Quran. People like Moses and Jesus and Abraham and so on. But the Quran does state that every civilization has received a prophet or a messenger or a warner. And so there is this idea that every civilization has somebody. And that's why you have some people speaking of maybe Hindu figures as being maybe prophets, maybe the Buddha. Of course, with the Buddha, you know, what we have of his teachings seems quite unlike what we have in the Quran. I mean, especially if you think about the Quran, you know, one God, one God, one God, one God, and then Buddha, it's don't worry about God. I'm simplifying, but you get the point. But in any case, yeah, there is this idea that every civilization has received a prophet. That is in the Quran. Yeah. Let's go in the back there, yeah. You actually, yeah.
Okay, so I have two questions. One, how do lay Muslims, people who aren't scholars, like what are the modern trends for how they respond to that question?
Yeah.
You know, people who, how does that vary? And then secondly, what's the consequence? Like, what's the consequence of how people decide to deal with this question, and how do they decide to live their life based on how they grapple with their thoughts on it?
Both great questions. First of all, I think it's going to vary by country and what you're exposed to. Put it this way, the more likely Muslims are to interact with non-Muslims, the more likely they are to have kind of an optimistic view of the afterlife. So for instance, if you were to, I haven't seen the latest polls out of Egypt, but this is the country I'm most familiar with. I would assume that most people in Egypt would be maybe surprised, they would be surely surprised by what some of the findings I've discussed here. And maybe they would find that problematic, this kind of, this idea that, so many people could go to heaven and I don't want to overgeneralize or stereotype, but I mean, just for anecdotally, just from my own conversations with my relatives in Egypt, that's the impression I get. There was a Gallup study a few years ago, and they asked American Muslims, what do you think? And I was surprised by the results. It was something like 57, 59% said that there are multiple paths that are equally true. So they're not just promoting inclusivism, they're promoting pluralism. And this is a majority. And then it was a relatively small percentage that was promoting exclusivism. So it varies, of course, by region. The other question about, what was it? It was such a good question, too. The consequence, yeah. What are the implications? Some would have us believe that there are serious implications for this clash of civilizations discourse. So, for example, in Sam Harris's book, which I referenced at the beginning, there's this idea that because Muslims supposedly believe that all non-Muslims go to hell, this makes it easier for them to attack and kill non-Muslims. And surely, I think with an exclusivist paradigm, you could imagine how that could be, you could imagine that. Okay, if I believe this person is damned, then maybe it's easier for me to harm that person. Maybe that's going on. But then the opposite is true, which is where, you know, you have people who, because they believe non-Muslims are going to hell, they might try to go out of their way to impress them, right? To try to save them, right? So it could go both ways. Similarly, the view that everyone will one day go to heaven. On the one hand, that could maybe bring about a kind of nonchalant attitude. Well, you know, everything is going to be made well anyway, so don't, you know, no worries about anything, really. Or it might lead you to see goodness in every single person, whether it's actual or latent, but you see goodness in every single person. You know that at some point, everyone will be good. So, and that could, of course, affect how you interact with people and how you think of them and so on. So this is kind of a crude analysis, but just to give you a sense, and I can just say from personal experience, you know, what I was taught growing up, I could see how it affected me. For example, some of my teachers taught that, yeah, every non-Muslim goes to hell forever. So when I was growing up, this is what I was taught. And I remember as a, you know, imagine me now as a little middle school student, you know, thinking, oh, poor John, he's going to hell forever. And God, I have to be really good with him. But then on the flip side, John gives me he's being, you know, a jerk. At least I'm not going to hell, you know, right? So you know, it can affect the way you think about things and how you interact with people. And I can just say anecdotally, I mean, or even just my own personal experience, I can see how that plays out. Yeah. Why don't we do, there's a question in the back there, somebody in the hat. I don't mean to draw attention to the hat, by the way, I'm sorry.
I was wondering, you said that like pagans and other people who hadn't heard necessarily about the Abrahamic traditions, that they were exempt and that they were just kind of, they were exempt. Does that mean that they automatically go to heaven, or does that mean that they're just kind of in limbo forever, or?
Great question. I mean, Al-Ghazali, the first person we looked at, first pre-modern person we looked at, he seems to imply that they're good to go. You know, never heard of the Prophet, never heard of Islam. He says God's mercy is on them. He doesn't go further than that. Now, later scholars who were inspired by Ghazali would expand on this. They'd say, no, they're still judged, but they're judged by what they knew to be good and evil. You know, he said, one person I have in mind here is Rashid Rida, who is a very prominent modern scholar, died in 1935, lived in Egypt, originally from Tripoli in modern-day Lebanon. And he says, everybody has a basic idea of good and evil. We disagree about all kinds of things, but we have a basic sense of good and evil. And so he says everybody will be judged in accordance by that standard. So even someone who's never heard of Islam, they would be judged by what they knew to be good and evil. But yeah, this is a controversial question. One that's, you know, because Ghazali never resolves it, many took Ghazali to task for this. And they said, well, gosh, based on that standard, if you're saying everybody goes to heaven because they never heard about Islam, then Islam is a curse. Don't tell anybody about Islam then. Because then everyone knows, everyone's off the hook. Everyone gets, you know. So But, you know, I'm not so sure that Ghazali was saying they necessarily go to heaven directly, but he leaves it open-ended. So, yeah, it's an issue that's, you know, debated. Yeah, good question, though. Other questions? I think we had one here.
Yeah. I'm trying to find, you said someone who believed, one of the schools of thought was that they believed deeds over creeds.
Yes.
So my question is basically, besides all these other, you know, alternative religions that are non-Abrahamic that we talked about, what about completely secularized people, if they do exist? What about people who do not find any faith to be, like, the ultimate truth and do not live religiously?
Right.
Would they be exempt in only that school of thought, or are they
so
completely, like, damned forever?
Well, certainly, yeah. Friedrich Hayek, he's the one who stresses deeds over creeds. And for him, yeah, someone who's an atheist could potentially be saved, right? But even if we go back to the pre-modern context, even if we go back to the medieval context, let's go back to Ghazali, Ibn Arabi, and Ibn Taymiyyah. Again, for them, they don't care what people believe about God. Now, there are other Muslim theologians who do. For example, there's a group called the Maturidites, or the Maturidiyya. They say you have to believe in God, no matter what you've been exposed to. But for Ghazali, Ibn Arabi, and Ibn Taymiyyah, they, you know, for them, it's just about what have you been exposed to and how do you respond to what you've been exposed to. That's what they're really focusing on. On the one hand, of course, they were used to, you know, most of their contemporaries were theists. They believed in God. They didn't encounter too many atheists. But for them to say that even pagans could be saved suggests that for them, it's not so much about what you believe concerning God. It's really more about, again, how do you respond to the divine message? And again, there are theologians who said, no, you still have to believe in God. You have to arrive at a belief in God independently of any, without any access to revelation. You still have to believe in God, but not these three. These three don't seem to stress that. Should we do maybe one more question? No pressure? How about no more questions? Okay, here we go. Yes.
Not a question, I just add an observation.
Oh, sure.
Excuse me, do you mind if I... Sorry.
Not a question. I just wanted to add a comment to which will probably substantiate the answer that you gave to this question that you asked and the earlier one, which goes back to verse 62 in chapter 2, where, according to some of the translations at least, where the emphasis... where it is, it's led to believe that those who believe in the oneness of God and in the messenger and who do righteous deeds, you can read the translation right there. Mm-hmm. I just want to draw attention to that.
Absolutely, yeah.
That answers the other faiths and anyone who, apart from the other faiths that I mentioned there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What's interesting is this is, again, the most often cited passage in pluralist discourse. And yet, for the pre-modern scholars that we looked at, Ghazali, Ibn Arabi, Ibn Taymiyyah, they don't cite this as often as you would think, interestingly. It seems like for them, their stress is that verse, we do not punish until we have sent a messenger. But nonetheless, they will still cite it. And going along with this idea that, yeah, there are non-Muslims who will be saved, and they cite and they use this verse to justify that position. So they still cite it, but it's not as pronounced, maybe, as in contemporary discourse. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then, under this passage, it would say that you would have to have faith in some kind of monotheistic God.
So here's the thing, though. For some, like the Maturidites, they would say, yeah, because of a passage like this, you have to believe in God. Others, though, the three that we looked at, they would say, I mean, look, this is not saying that the others are going to be damned necessarily. All it's saying is that these people who are righteous and have faith, they're good. They're good to go. But they would also say, again, they would go back to that qualification, we do not punish until we have sent a messenger. So there's no punishment until a messenger has arrived. And then there's the question, what does that mean, you know, for somebody to encounter the messenger or the message? At what point have you received the message? That's where you get the debate. And it looks like that has inspired two questions. Why don't we do it? Let's just do two more questions. Yes. Maybe in the purple first, yeah?
Well, actually, mine's a separate question.
So. Oh, okay. Then we'll go here.
I've been thinking about that other verse in Quran where the Prophet ﷺ is sort of given to attend to spreading the faith, where Allah says that if it was up to me, I would make everybody Muslim. Your work is just to send the message.
Right.
No one has discussed that.
No, there is that passage that is also invoked. And I think Sashadina actually mentions Sashadina him. I think he actually has a whole article on that verse. But the one that I guess tends to be quoted more often is this one. Yeah, but you're right. There is that passage. I don't want to give the number because I probably won't give the right one off the top of my head. But yeah.
No, but I just wanted to
know that. There are similar passages.
Very pertinent.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then in the purple.
It kind of just struck me quickly. The Christians disagree in terms of the form that the body or the soul goes into heaven. Is there any discourse on this in Islam?
Oh, yes. A lot of debate regarding the nature of the afterlife. Is it a bodily resurrection? Is it a spiritual resurrection? For someone like Al-Ghazali, the first scholar we looked at, for Al-Ghazali, you have to believe that there's that there's bodily resurrection. In fact, if you don't, he says you cannot be a Muslim. But he would say it's an alternative body. It's not our current bodies. This is something, when you look at the Quranic descriptions of the afterlife, it's all, most scholars would concede that these are just approximations. They're not meant to be taken so literally. Because, for example, there's a famous report where the Prophet says that heaven has what no eye has seen, no ear has heard, which sounds a lot like Paul in 1 Corinthians, by the way. And so many say that these descriptions of the afterlife are just approximations, just so you can get a sense of what's going on. There's a passage in the Quran. Throughout the Quran, you have descriptions of gardens and rivers. But one passage in the Quran, at least, says that the parable or the likeness of heaven is gardens and rivers. So suddenly we start thinking maybe this is just, it's not meant to be taken so literally. Maybe there's something. When the Quran describes hell, it says the fire, in one passage, the fire rises over their hearts. Is that meant to be taken literally? So Muslims debate, but there's a general agreement that we really can't know for sure what the afterlife is like, that it's ultimately ambiguous. Yeah. And with that, I think I shall conclude. Thank you all.